are taught this, and the importance of it is emphasized. But like many other lessons that we study in a children's class, this is one that I think too often we look at as a very elementary thing, and we depart from it as we mature, as we grow older. And this is really the very foundation of everything that we need to be doing as a Christian. You know, the Bible speaks about the importance and the value of reputation, of the influence that we have in this world. As a matter of fact, I believe that the Bible reveals to us that our reputation, our name, or our influence that we have in this world is probably one of the most valuable commodities that we have in this life. It is something that cannot be purchased with money. It is something that can only be built over a long period of time. And it is something that we must value and maintain if we're to do any good for the cause of Christ at all. In Ecclesiastes chapter 7 and in verse 1, Ecclesiastes chapter 7 and verse 1, the wise man says, "A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth." Now, when he speaks about a good name being is better than precious ointment, what we've got to understand is the Eastern culture when the Bible was written. A precious ointment was going to be an oil. And the oils that they used in that time were one of the most valuable things that they had. There were certain textiles, silk and other things like that, that were some of the most expensive possessions that people had. But other than that, the oils, the ointments, were the other thing that people valued above all other things. They bartered with these, they bought, they sold, but precious ointment is the idea of being valuable. It is hard to find. Very few people have it. We read about Jesus being anointed with an ointment like this prior to his death, and Judas criticizing that because he said it could have been sold for a great deal of money and given to the poor, which of course he intended to embezzle that money in the first place. But we've got to understand that the point is not ointment in the sense as it is the value of that. He's giving us one of the most valuable things that they knew. And this good name is more valuable. It is a greater commodity than that. In Proverbs 22 and in verse 1, "A good name is rather to be chosen than great riches, and loving favor rather than silver and gold." Again, emphasizing to us the value and the importance of influence, of reputation. We read in Matthew 5 and verses 13 through 16, "You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has lost its flavor, wherewith shall it be salted? It is therefore good for nothing but to be cast out and to be trampled under the foot of men." He's talking about the saving power of salt. Salt had a preserving power, and this is speaking directly about the influence, the saving or the preserving influence that we have over other people. If we destroy our reputation, if we handle with a flippancy our reputation and our influence, then we will lose that ability to be able to preserve, to be able to save, is what he's talking about. And of course, the light of the world. Luke gives us his parallel in Luke 14 in verses 34 through 35. Luke says, "Salt is good, but if the salt has lost its savor, wherewith shall it be seasoned? It is neither fit for the land, nor yet for the dunghill, but men cast it out. He that hath ears to hear, let him hear." All of these, just a few of the many passages in the Bible that speak about the importance of our reputation, of our influence, and how we need to hold on to that and maintain it. I want you to think about the fact that if Satan wants to destroy the cause of Christ, if he wants to impact and to destroy the souls of men and women in this world, one of the fastest ways to do that is to destroy our influence on this world, is to destroy our reputation in the community or in the social circle in which we live. Because once we have lost that preserving, that saving influence that we can have on others, once we have reached a point to where people no longer care to listen to us, they have no value for what we might think or say, for whatever reason, we've destroyed our influence, then Satan has won, to a large degree, the battle that he's fighting for the souls of men and women. In order to win for the cause of Christ, we've got to maintain that. So how is it that we can ruin that influence? How is it that we can lose our reputation and lose the power that Jesus would have us to have to bring others to Him? Well, there are a number of different ways, but I want to look at a few of them this morning. And one of the first that I want you to consider with me that I think is obvious, maybe one of the most obvious, one of the first ways that we can ruin our influence in our community, in our social circle, in the people, among the people that we live around, is by simply being inconsistent. That is to say one thing and to do another. To profess something, but to live a different life. You know, there have been those people that have disappointed me terribly through their inconsistency in how they apply one set of rules to some people and another set of rules to themselves and to their friends. This is one of the ways that we can be inconsistent. That we expect a certain behavior of this person, but then we will judge by a different set of rules ourselves. And that is what Matthew chapter 7 is talking about when he says in verse 1, "Judge not that you be not judged." He's not telling us that we are not to discern by a person's behavior what kind of person they are. He tells us in that same chapter in verse 20, "By their fruits you will know them." In other words, by their conduct, you will know their heart. He wasn't telling us not to discern that. But in Matthew 7 and verse 1, when he says, "Judge not that you be not judged," he goes on to say in verse 2, "For with what judgment you judge, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured back to you." What he's saying is that I do not need to use one set of scales when I buy something and another set of scales when I sell. I need to be consistent. I need to be fair. I need to use the same judgment on this person as I would use on myself, my family, or my friends. And this is the kind of inconsistency that when people see that in our lives, they lose respect for us. We lose our preserving influence on that person or those persons. Inconsistency. Proverbs 26 and verse 7 says, "The legs of the lame are not equal, so is a parable in the mouth of fools." A parable being a wise saying. And what he's saying is that it doesn't fit. This wise saying in the mouth of a fool does not fit. It doesn't go together. You know, the Bible in the New Testament uses the word translated modest. It talks about modest apparel and those that adorn themselves in modest apparel. It is the Greek word cosmos. We get our word cosmos, or it's the idea of an orderly arrangement. We use the cosmos speaking about the planetary system and the stars, and that God has set that in such an orderly arrangement that man could never even comprehend. And this is the Greek word that describes the way that a Christian is to dress or adorn themselves, but the word is used in a number of other ways. We find it there in 1 Timothy in chapter 2 speaking about the adornment that one wears who professes godliness in 1 Timothy chapter 2 in about verses 8 and 9. He says that in chapter 2 and in verse 9, "In like manner also that the women adorn themselves in modest apparel," cosmos apparel, "orderly," or well ordered, "with propriety and moderation, not with braided hair of gold or pearls or costly clothing, but which is proper for women professing godliness with good works." What he's saying is that when a person is professing godliness, that is, a proper fear of God, then they need to adorn themselves in a way that is fitting or well ordered with that. Something that does not stand out as a contrast. Something that doesn't seem like it doesn't fit. "The legs of the lame are unequal," as is a proverb in the mouth of a fool. People see that doesn't work. That doesn't match up. That's not cosmos. It's not modest. And he uses the same word in chapter 3 of 1 Timothy. When he talks about an elder, he says in verse 2, "A bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife, temperate, sober-minded, of good behavior." The word good there, actually both words, good behavior, the word good is cosmos, and he's talking about a behavior that is well-ordered, well-arranged with that profession, that person who would be an overseer of the church. And so when we're thinking about consistency in our life, what we've got to understand is that we don't fool most people. There may be some gullible people that we're able to pull something over on them, but most people around us, they see in our life when there is inequity. When they see that our behavior does not match our profession. And that kind of inconsistency and hypocrisy has caused me and many others not to listen to what a person says or to what they might write when I see that kind of inconsistency in them. How can we follow or listen to advice from somebody who is inconsistency? And if I act the same way, then I'm going to diminish my influence. Ecclesiastes 10 is another passage that I think points this out. In Ecclesiastes 10 and in verse 1. In Ecclesiastes 10 and in verse 1, the wise man says, "Dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savor. So does a little folly or foolishness him that is in reputation for wisdom and honor." The person who has a reputation for wisdom, all it takes is just a little bit of foolishness to completely destroy the respect that people might have for them. And you know, this is so true. We see it many times in the political realm. A man who has lived his life in an honorable and respectful way, he has shown wisdom in the management of his life or of his family, of his finances, his own personal policies, business policies. And so this man is put forward as a political front runner. And everyone is getting really geared up about following this man, and he's going to be a great leader. And it only takes one act of folly, one act of foolishness that can taint everything else that is good. And many times we might think, well, that's unfair because it's just one thing in this person's life. But it is the way, it is what it is. That's the way that it works. As a matter of fact, it's almost the wiser that a man is, the more damage that one act of foolishness can do because of inequity. You see, when a person is known for foolishness and there is some wisdom in their life, we expect that. We're not surprised by that kind of thing. That is the way of their life. We may not have that greater respect for them, but when they commit some act of foolishness, well, they just kind of go back and forth. But when a person is known for wisdom, for spirituality, and then we see that foolishness, that inconsistency in their life, that inequity is glaring. It stands out. And as Christians, we've got to understand this. We are under a microscope, if you will, in many ways. People are, our enemies are looking for that mistake, just like with a political front runner. People are looking for demons in their closet. Sometimes we say, well, he's got to be a Boy Scout in order to make it. Well, to some degree, using that metaphor, as Christians, we've got to have that kind of life. That's why it's emphasized so much to be without spot and blameless. You'll say, well, I'm human, I can't be perfect. We're not saying that a person has to have never sinned in their life, but I want to tell you that when we are living inconsistent, when there is inequity, then it's going to be glaring in our life. And I'm not talking just about here is a mistake, some act of inadvertence, and we immediately repent and we correct it. But I'm talking about when there is an area of my life that continues on, that goes on without correction. And I justify it by saying, well, that's just me. Well, I've always been that way. And we are wise and spiritually minded in all these other areas of our life, but in this one area, we're unwilling to resolve the problem. That is where it's going to be glaring and where we're going to totally ruin our influence on the world. I want you to notice in Romans chapter 2. In Romans chapter 2 and in verse 21, he says, "You therefore who teach another, do you not teach yourself? You who preach a man should not steal, do you steal?" He's talking about the inconsistency of the Jews. The Jews were extremely critical of the Gentiles and of the Samaritans, and yet they themselves were guilty of many times the same crimes. It may not have manifested itself in the same way, but they were just as guilty of sin. When we do that as Christians, the world is going to ridicule and mock those of us who profess to be children of God. And we see it happen all the time around us. This inequity in life, this bold profession of one's faith, and then this aspect of one's life that it tries to be hidden and put back here. I'm old enough to remember Jim and Tammy Baker. And some of you here can remember the debacle of this televangelist and how he was supposed to be so humble and so spiritual and so righteous in his life. And then we find out that there is gross immorality in his life. Jimmy Swaggart as well. And these are the kinds of inconsistencies that give people a reason then to cast aspersion on the cause of Christ. Not that these men were following the cause of Christ in every aspect of their life, but they were an excuse for people to oppose it. God warns us about this in Romans 2 and in verse 21. What we've got to make sure is that our life is consistent, that what we expect of another person is what we expect of ourselves, that what we profess is what we live. The story is told about a building contractor who was being paid by the week for a job that was supposed to stretch out over several months. And he approached the owner of the property about a check that he had been given. And he said, "This is $200 less than what we agreed on." And the building owner said, "Well, I know that. But last week I overpaid you by $200 and you didn't have a problem with that." Well, the building contractor said, "Well, I understand, but I don't mind an occasional mistake, but when it becomes a habit, I think that it needs to be called out." That's the inconsistency there. As long as he was being overpaid, it was all right. But when he's underpaid, now it's wrong. And while most of us understand that, that's really kind of the way that some people are living. They're okay as long as it benefits them, but then when it goes the other way, they're not going to approve of it. We need to be consistent. We need to be honest in our life. I want you to notice another thing that the Bible brings out that will certainly destroy our influence on the world, and that is by being unreliable. You know, if you want to ruin a good influence, just don't be dependable. When people ask you to do something, when they give you a job or a task, don't always do what you're asked to do. Do it sometimes, but don't always do it. Don't always do what you're expected to do. Don't be responsible. Don't do your duty regularly. Just do it intermittently, where sometimes it's done, sometimes you can be counted on, and other times you cannot. Sometimes you're on time, many times you're late. You never know what's going to happen in regard to that responsibility. Never ever volunteer or choose to go beyond your duty. And if you do volunteer, be sure that you do not completely follow through with what you volunteered to do. That will ruin, absolutely destroy your influence. Because no one has respect for that. It means that you're not trustworthy. You don't do what you say that you're going to do, which goes back to that issue of inconsistency. When you promise to do something, don't follow through with it. Don't complete it. When you borrow money, don't pay it back as you've promised. These are the kinds of things that you can do. If you want to destroy your influence, destroy your reputation, that is a sure way to do it. Now, obviously, I'm not telling you to do this. I'm just simply recounting what we see happen in the lives of a lot of Christians. And they wonder why people lack respect for them. They wonder why they are not looked upon as a leader or why people do not come to them in the community. It is because they are completely unreliable. And as I pointed out, one of the areas that this is most common today in is financially. When people promise to do something to pay back a debt and it is never done as they say it will be done, they do not keep their word and are not trustworthy in coming through. I want to ask you, would you hire a person with that kind of attitude? Would you want to marry somebody who never did what they said that they were going to do, never followed through with their promises, never could be relied upon to accomplish what their responsibility was, or who would volunteer but then never come through with it? How do people respond to somebody who's unreliable? Well, they don't trust them. They don't listen to them. They don't ask them to do a job. They don't give them any responsibility because it's going to come back on them. They don't depend on them to do what they say. And they are not influenced by them. It destroys our ability to lead these people to Christ. You know, we've heard the saying, "Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me." People who have been burned by an unreliable person don't easily forget it. And it is very difficult for them to hear spiritual truths that would transform their life from a person that is completely unreliable. In 2 Kings chapter 18, in 2 Kings 18 and verse 21, the Bible speaks and warns about trusting those who are unreliable. God, through the prophet here, says, "Look now, you are depending on Egypt, that splintered reed of a staff, which pierces a man's hand and wounds him if he leans on it. Such is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who depend on him." This was actually a spokesman for another country. This was not directly from God. But it is one of those sayings in the Bible that emphasizes that people understand how painful an unreliable person is. It's described as a splintered staff or a walking stick that a person leans on for support, and it breaks and it runs through the hand of the person that leans on it. The very staff that is supposed to provide support actually injures further the person who is already injured. Thus, they need a staff. In Proverbs 25, the wise man speaks again about this. Proverbs 25 and in verse 19. He says, "Confidence in an unfaithful man in time of trouble is like a broken tooth and a foot out of joint." Now, we understand what that's all about. A broken tooth, a foot out of joint, and not many things that are much more painful than that. We cannot rely upon them. It completely changes our life. It makes us absolutely miserable in everything that we do. Confidence in an unfaithful man. You know, Paul had experience with those who were unreliable. In Acts chapter 15 and in verse 38, Paul decided not to take John Mark with them to do the work because John Mark had left them. He had departed from them when they were in Pamphylia and did not continue with them to the work. At that point in John Mark's life, he was unreliable. Now, I don't want to be too hard on John Mark, because I would expect that there was some severe persecution and suffering that they were going through. But it is obvious that God expected him to follow through with the commitment that he had made. He served them. He agreed to go on this trip. He no doubt was prepared for what was there. He should have counted the cost. And at some point, he turned back. And because of that, Paul said, "I'm not taking him with me again." Because Paul understood that putting his confidence in an unreliable man was like a broken tooth, like a foot out of joint. It would have hindered his ability to do the work. He needed someone that he could absolutely count on. Of course, John Mark was a cousin to Barnabas, and he was certainly giving him more patience, and so Paul and Barnabas separated as a result of that. Paul took with him Silas. But again, what we see is that Paul has had some experiences like this. Look in 2 Timothy 4 and in verse 16. In 2 Timothy 4 and in verse 16, Paul said, "At my first answer, no man stood with me, but all men forsook me. I pray God that it may not be laid to their charge." Verse 17, "Nevertheless, the Lord stood with me and strengthened me, that by me the preaching might be fully known, that all the Gentiles might hear, and I was delivered out of the mouth of the lion." Paul says the Lord came through. He had what he needed, but he says as far as everybody else there, he was sorely disappointed. They let him down. In chapter 4 of 2 Timothy and in verse 10, Paul said, "Demas has forsaken me, having loved this present world." Paul's life seemed to be filled with people who constantly let him down, people that were unreliable. Now, John Mark proved himself later. It is not that we cannot restore ourselves. It is not that we cannot make a transformation of life and become reliable again, but it does not happen overnight. It cannot be done in a day. And that influence that we destroy by our being unreliable is going to take a long time to gain back. And in that period of time, when we've lost our reputation and lost our influence, we can do very little good for the cause of Christ. Certainly we can turn around and be right with God and start building our reputation again. But as far as God's concerned, we're not a lot of help to Him. Until enough time has passed, that consistency is there, and we can be shown to be reliable. I want you to notice another area where we can destroy our influence, not only by being inconsistent, by being unreliable, but also I want to suggest to you that we can destroy our influence with the world and people around us, our ability to influence them for good to Christ by simply being unfriendly. And I realize that not everyone is just gregarious in their life. They're not the life of the party, the person who's never met a stranger. Not all of us are like that. I understand. But all people can be friendly. We simply have to have a will to do that. In the same way that somebody says, well, not all people can be disciplined with their anger, Brett. Yes, they can. Now, I understand not everybody's going to be calm as a stone. Somebody says, well, not everybody can control their speech. Yes, they can. Not everybody is going to be of few words, but they can control their speech. And in that same way, everyone can be friendly. That doesn't mean, again, that you're going to be the life of the party, but friendly to the people that you're around. In Luke chapter 11, in verses 5 through 8, in Luke chapter 11, I want you to notice there in verses 5 through 8, Jesus says, which of you shall have a friend and go to him at midnight and say to him, friend, lend me 3 loaves, for a friend of mine has come to me on his journey and I have nothing to set before him. And he will answer from within and say, do not trouble me. The door is now shut. My children are with me in bed. I cannot rise and give to you. I say to you, though he will not rise and give to him because he is a friend, yet because of his persistence, he will rise and give to him as many as he needs. He's talking here about the influence and the power of friendship. Now we understand that it only goes so far, and Jesus is even pointing that out here. That friendship can only go so far. There's some things that sometimes we can take advantage of a friendship, and that would have been the case of waking one's neighbor up in the middle of the night. He says he's not going to get up and do it because you're a friend, but if you persist, then he will. But there is still an understanding in this text that there is an influence that we can have as a result of being friends. There are some things that we can count on from our friends. In Proverbs 18 and verse 24, the wise man said, a man who has friends must himself be friendly. Now this principle holds true throughout the generations. Those who act in a friendly manner will receive in like manner the reaction of friendship. When a person is friendly to other people, they're going to receive that kind of response, which opens the door for us to be able to lead a person to Christ, to show them Christ, to talk to them about Christ. But when we are unfriendly, when we give the impression that we don't care at all about that person, but then in a Bible study we're going to sit down and talk to them about what's wrong in their life and what they need to make right, it's going to be very difficult for us to have any influence on that person. People need to know how much we care. And we show that by how friendly we are. And that is done in our everyday life. It's certainly done in the assembly. As we come in and we worship together, as we have visitors or travelers that come through, but it's done every day in our life with the people that we deal with. You know, I don't enjoy being around people who are unfriendly, do you? I don't know of anybody that says, that's who I like to be around. I want to find the most unfriendly people. I want to find the most unfriendly place to live in, and that's what I really enjoy. I'm unfriendly if I respond to people in like manner when they're unfriendly to me, though. This is another thing that I've got to understand. Somebody says, I know what you're talking about, Brett. I just can't stand that. When people, they're unfriendly, they won't speak, they seem like they don't care at all about you or about your life or anything to do with you. Well, how do we respond to that? This is one of the things that we need to remember. If people are unfriendly to me, what am I to do? Well, you know, when I respond in like manner, then that makes me like them. If people are unfriendly to me, so I'm unfriendly to them, then what am I? And how am I better than they are? We've got to make sure that we are friendly to everyone. If I react to someone's meanness, their crudeness, or their vulgarity, then I'm playing their game. In other words, if I use the same kind of language they use, or I come back with a snide comment, then all I do is I dance on the end of their string. I become like them. I've allowed their problem to become my problem. If I respond to their meanness, their vulgarity, their crudeness with graciousness, with kindness, it's still their problem, but I don't let them decide how I live. Who's running your life? If you simply react to everyone in the same manner that they're acting, then they're running your life. You're a reactive person. You see, we've got to make sure that no matter who we encounter, it doesn't matter what kind of people I work with, it doesn't even matter who I'm married to, what matters is who I am and what kind of person I'm going to be, because I am in absolute control of that. But if I allow myself to be reactive and simply do what other people are doing to me, then I'm not in control of my life. I'm no better than they are. I'm going to blame somebody out there, and I'm going to try to hold them responsible for what I'm doing. You know, the truth is that when I'm unfriendly, I don't care. When I'm unfriendly, I don't care. Because things or people that we care about, we take an interest in. We ask questions about. We can be friendly. Proverbs 18 and 24, the wise man said, a man that has friends must show himself friendly. And then he goes on to say, and there is a friend that sticketh closer than a brother. That's the kind of friendship that we need to manifest in our life. Proverbs 17 and in verse 17, a friend loves at all times and a brother is born for adversity. That's what people need to see in us, that we're genuine, that we care about them, that we care about their life. Someone has said, until people know how much we care, they won't care how much we know. Certainly, we need to know God's will. We need to be able to share it with other people. But it's going to be difficult for us to have much influence on them unless we genuinely have an interest in their life. Romans chapter 5 and in verse 5, it says, the love of God is shed abroad in our hearts. How is that done? How is the love of God shed abroad in our hearts? How is it shown in that way? It is shown by how much we care, by how friendly we are, by how interested we are in other people. Then I want you to notice, fourth, that if we want to destroy our influence, not only can we do it being unfriendly, but also by being quick-tempered. This is one that we talk about a number of times, but it's one that we need to be mindful of. And I would expect that all of us, to one degree or another, have that place in our life where our buttons can be pushed. Maybe we can go a lot longer than this person. We can be critical of this person for being quick to anger. But most of us have some point where we've allowed ourselves to reach that tipping point. The Bible warns us not to do that. In Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 9, do not be hasty in your spirit to be angry, for anger rests in the bosom of fools. That needs to be a memory verse. It needs to be on our mirror. We need to remember that anger brings about no good thing. Proverbs 22 and in verse 24, make no friendship with an angry man, and with a furious man do not go. That's telling us that we don't need to have that kind of a friendship, that doesn't need to be the kind of people that we associate with, because not only are they going to influence us, but we're also going to suffer because of the messes that they get us into. In Proverbs 14 and verse 17, he who is quick to anger deals foolishly, and a man of wicked devices is hated. In James chapter 1, he says in verse 19, so then, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. For the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. It's not going to do anything good. It's always going to be detrimental. And of course, the word wrath here is not talking about the kind of anger that God has over sin, or the fact that we can be angry and sin not, but wrath is when we've reached that point of being out of control, when we handle ourselves in a way that hurts others. Proverbs 14 and 29 says, he who is slow to wrath is of great understanding, But he who is of a hasty spirit exalts folly or foolishness. Joseph Hunter said, "My life is in the hands of any fool who makes me lose my temper." Going back to that point that we made earlier, am I reactive or proactive? Who's in control of my life? Well, when I allow somebody who's unfriendly or mean to me, cause me to be unfriendly or mean, they're in control of my life. And when I allow someone to cause me to push my buttons, as we might say, cause me to lose my temper, then my life is in their hands. I am in their control. Surely we want to be more independent than that. We want to gain control of our own life. But when we lose our temper, we lose our ability to affect and influence others for good. No one wants to be around someone who flies off the handle. They're afraid that they're going to be blamed, afraid they're going to be hurt. Proverbs 15 and verse 1 says, "A soft answer turns away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger." Let's always be the kind of people that is able to bring that into control and to choose the right words. If no one wants to be around somebody who's soon to anger, how can that person who is soon to anger ever influence other people when no one wants to be around them? Yes, this is one of the ways we can destroy our influence. Well, there are quite a number of things that we could look at here. I want to close with this final one, and that is an uncontrolled tongue. We understand that this overlaps and goes together with being quick to anger, but few things will destroy our influence faster than a loose tongue. People consider a person who can't control their tongue as being foolish. Ecclesiastes 5 and in verse 3, he says, "A dream comes through the multitude of business or work, and a fool's voice is known by a multitude of words." When a person talks too much, they're known as being a fool. And we lose influence. We say things that cannot be taken back. Proverbs 27 and verse 2 says, "Let another man praise you and not your own mouth." This is one of the ways that people lose their influence, is by bragging. They say too much, by talking about themselves too much. In Proverbs 26, he talks about being a talebearer and telling things on other people. Proverbs 26 and verse 20, "Where no wood is, the fire goes out. So where there is no talebearer, the strife ceases." There's so many different ways where we can destroy our influence by not being in control of our tongue. Proverbs 10 says in verse 19, "Let your words be few." He says, "In the multitude of words, sin is not lacking, but he who refrains his lips is wise." Proverbs 15 and verse 28, "The heart of the righteous studies the proper answer, but the mouth of the wicked pours out evil things." And then finally in Colossians 4 and verse 6, "Let your speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer every man." Again, the point here is that if we want to really have an impact on the lives of others, to lift up and to magnify Jesus Christ, we have to build and maintain our reputation and our influence. And these are some ways that we might overlook from time to time. While we may not live in gross immorality, we can still destroy our ability to influence others to Christ by simply not paying attention to these areas of our life. Appreciate your kind attention. We'll dismiss at this time and go to our classes.